Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Pod and the Pendulum, the show that covers horror movie franchises one movie at a time and one episode at a time. And this is Devon Taylor possessing Mike's host chair while he is out with the flu. We wish our captain a speedy recovery. But while he's away, it is time to play Bloody Mary as we discuss Paranormal Activity 3. And I am not alone, as I am joined by our own coven of witches, returning from the first Paranormal Activity episodes. We have Jessica Scott from We Who Walk Here.
Hey, I'm excited to be here. Talk about that oscillating fan cam and granny witches and lots of fun stuff in a very good installment.
We have lots of expanded goodies for this one. As well, we have Ariel Powershaub, author of the upcoming Millennial Nasties. How are we doing?
Happy to be back. Super afraid of Bloody Mary, so gonna get into it.
And once again, returning our found footage expert, dare I say, editor-in-chief over at Dread Central and co-host of the Scarred for Life podcast, it is Mary Beth McAndrews.
So excited to be here and talk about this movie, one of the most influential horror movies of all time, dare I say.
I mean, that could be said about this entire franchise, honestly. I mean, you know, already kind of talked about, you know, it being an innovative franchise for one. And then obviously, as the series goes on, we have a lot of expanded lore to talk about today. So very excited. So let's go ahead and get into some background info so that way we can get to the goodies. So this one was released October 21st, 2011, and serves as a prequel mostly set 18 years prior to the events of the first two films. This was directed by Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, who both directed the documentary Catfish, which I think was a interesting directing duo to bring in, because this came out the year after their Catfish documentary, but before the MTV spinoff series. So this was like kind of in between, and they marketed.
Was anyone else obsessed with Catfish, the documentary, before the show?
Yes.
I never saw the documentary before the show.
I never saw the show.
Neither did I, because yeah. I watched this documentary and it like fucking broke my heart, because it's actually like quite sad. Like, it's really sad. And it was marketed. Is this okay to talk about now? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Oh, no, that's exactly what we're getting into.
I want to talk about the Catfish documentary, because like, I was thought it was like, they marketed it as like horror, as like something crazy was going to happen. Yeah. And it ends up being this like woman who's caretaking for a child, one of her children or something. And she's just like a really sad woman in the suburbs who just like was looking for something to take her out of her really sad life.
Yeah, she was like a down on her luck like artist. And that was like in part of like the whole thing with Nev, like not only being catfished by this, you know, relationship he started, but like catfished by a family that she like kind of made up and into addition to everything.
She made a whole family. Like, it was. And so I think I just don't take this show as seriously. And like, I don't mean to sound like a snotty asshole about that. I just like the documentary was just like pretty poignant, actually, and like what it was saying. And then I feel like the show, I mean, I get why the show got popular, but it took what I thought was like a pretty thoughtful look at how people use the internet to cope with trauma and kind of exploited it for money. Which, like, I mean, look, I get it. But at the same time, the documentary is such a different tone than the show, which is why I was kind of stoked to see them take on Paranormal Activity. Because there is, like, again, even though they're kind of douchebags in the show, at least I see them as douchebags, like, in the show. And they kind of don't have that same kind of pathos they have in the original documentary. I feel it in this movie. So I just wanted to nerd out, because I loved that documentary. And, like, it made me so sad. Because my friend used to catfish people online. And so this, like, I watched this and I was like, I think you need to stop catfishing boys online.
And the term catfish came because of that documentary.
Yes.
Like, he said the way like we use that word now.
Barrel.
Right. And so that when you went to see the documentary Catfish, you did not know what it was going to end up being. That. because we didn't know the word catfish yet. So like now, if you've never watched it, but you know it's called Catfish, you probably have a good idea of what's coming, but it came from that documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that was at the beginning of, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the documentary is like fascinating too, because like it's marketed as a documentary, but then it's also like kind of presented as, like you said, like almost like a horror film. And then they kind of, they kind of did that weird blending. And like when people would, you know, ask them if it was like a fake mockumentary, like kind of style, they would like kind of shrug it off and like change the subject. And so they were very like loose with it. So Jessica, like, what do you think about, you know, them kind of taking that blurred approach to that and how that would translate into a real found footage horror film?
Honestly, I was aware of Catfish, the show, and the documentary, but I've never seen either. Like, you know, obviously I learned what catfishing meant and everything after the fact, but so I didn't have a lot of experience with it because I kind of avoided it. I'm not sure why. I just like avoided it. But it kind of, I think part of it just made me feel gross, which I know is not a very like intelligent or academic thing to say, but it just made me feel gross. Like the whole,
but like it is.
Yeah.
I worry that the show also like got people realizing you could do it too. And I'm curious if that, and I have no proof of that. You know what I mean? But like, I'm curious. Cause there was like a whole catfishing scandal at my school too. So I've just like, there's been a lot of catfishing has a lot of it in my life for some odd reason, but bored kids in the suburbs with the internet access, I guess.
They like framed some of the episodes too, because like, again, like in the earlier seasons of the show, it still like kind of, you know, had more of that cautionary tale kind of vibe to it that the documentary had. But then as it goes on, I mean, it's still going on technically. And like, you know, I guess they need these things to still keep happening, you know, for them to keep making episodes. So like, yeah, in a way it might have, you know, perpetuated, you know, more catfish incidents. So very fascinating that they were kind of brought in to do this. Jason Blum, Oren Peli, and Steven Schneider produced, along with Akiva Goldsman serving as executive producer. Christopher B. Landon returned to write the script for this one. And another returning team member as well that I think is important to the franchise is Gregory Plotkin, who has edited, he edited 2, 3, 4 and The Marked Ones. And if you guys don't know, he went on to direct Hellfest. I know that's a favorite of Mike. Again, he's not here to appreciate it, but that one's for you, buddy.
I like Hellfest too. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think it's very fun. I think, again, like kind of having a consistent editor on for the franchise also kind of helps out with the consistency and like kind of keeping, trying to keep the timeline straight. And but we'll get into more editor notes a little bit later with some of my lore theories. So in some of the trailers, many of the scenes weren't shown in the final cut, which kind of angered a lot of fans. They also kind of did use the social media strategy once again to tweet your scream campaign in preparation for a release. And I see something about a Paranormal Activity 3 Demon Summoner app. Does anybody have any info on that? Because that is very funny to do.
I tried to, so I found a reference to it on Wikipedia or something, and I tried to find out more. And maybe I'm just not very good at Googling, but like, I couldn't find out much about what this was. There was a period of time where like everything had an app, and like there were the commercials that said there's an app for that. And so I think this was maybe just sort of capitalizing on that. But I don't want any kind of app that summons a demon. Oh my God, that's too easy and too scary. I won't even look at a Ouija board. You think I'm going to put an app on my phone?
I have seen Pulse. I know what happens when ghosts get access to the internet. We're not doing this.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it is like a very interesting transition. Obviously, it's, you know, like we're in modern day, which is kind of interesting for the film because this one's a prequel. So it's like in the prequel, obviously, it would be a Ouija board, which we've seen in the previous two films anyways. But then transitioning to a Demon Summoner app to, you know, keep things modern in the modern day. And speaking of which, with modern technology, the camera scene on screen during most of the film is actually a tiny high definition camera that they hid inside the body of a VHS camcorder. So for the first few weeks of shooting, they didn't even have a viewfinder to kind of see what they were actually shooting. There's a quote here. It said, so what they had to do was they built they put in a screen, a little monitor in the viewfinder that was transmitting the video that it was recording in the body of this old VHS tape into this monitor. So I was basically watching our little monitor in the viewfinder, and it was like 6 weeks in when they finally figured that out. They did originally talk about shooting it on VHS, but the studio didn't want to release a film in the 4:3 aspect ratio, which I'm a slut lame. For sidebars. I would have loved that.
That's what do you guys, lame.
Yeah. What do you guys,
so cool.
What do you guys think about the way that they kind of, again, like kind of mixing the old with the new to kind of get this experience? Like, do you think it pulls off the prequel 80s look enough with the filter that they kind of put over the footage?
We're it's all kind of doing the
listeners, a lot of handshakes just now.
Well, and it's hard now because I feel like, especially in the last, like, even last year or so, we've embraced the VHS aesthetic so much more. So it's like rewatching this so soon, during this VHS analog boom we're seeing, it's just like a little bit of a bummer because I had never really thought about it as much, but now it's like, damn, I wish they had embraced it. I get, you know, studios, etc., but I don't think it's a good enough filter.
They could have made they could have made it look a little dirtier. It's still a little
They definitely
need more grain.
Because the production design for the 80s is great. I think the house, everything, but it looks like they filmed it on an iPhone. So it breaks that immersion a little bit when you're like, wait, this is too clear. So
I think they make up for it a little bit with like Dennis's old school command center where he has like all these like old style TVs with knobs and he's like, you know, doing all the things.
I used to work at an archive and it looked just like this. And I worked in the archive in 2019. So there are still some dudes out there with these setups that are like recording to like translating tapes over and digitizing them with these rad ass setups. So guys, the future. It's not here for some of you.
Yeah, so I mean we'll continue on with some of the filmmaking techniques when we get into the our found footage rules, if you will. The film did break some financial records upon its release, setting a new record for a midnight opening for a horror film with $8 million and the best opening day for a horror film in the United States, $26.2 million. Roger Ebert gave the film a single star out of four, stating that the appeal has worn threadbare, but predicted that the film would fare well at the box office nevertheless. Roger Ebert, he was feeling the fatigue a little bit. Were you guys kind of feeling any fatigue going into this one?
Absolutely not. Give me more. Give me one a year.
Yeah, I was like full into one a year. Like, I was so into it. And especially because this one was so different. I remember being excited because of how different it looked. Like, going back, using VHS tapes. And again, like, that wasn't a big thing in found footage at this time either yet. Like, using that VHS aesthetic was not the thing. So, and like, period pieces, as much as it's weird to call the 80s a period piece, like, but like, essentially, like, found footage period pieces were not a thing either. So
it's true.
Yeah. And I was not like, I didn't watch these movies like as they were coming out in the theater. So it wasn't like, oh my God, there's another one coming out. I like, caught up on them later. And I found this one super exciting, not only because like, I'm pretty much the same age as Katie. I'm a year younger than her. So it was scarier to me because I was like, you know, I didn't live in a house just like that, but like I recognized the milieu, the like I grew up in the 80s and I it felt like very real to me because my dad would follow us around with this huge camcorder on his shoulder, you know, like I related more to that aesthetic than like, oh, I'm filming my life with an iPhone because that's not how I grew up. But like, and just technically we'll get into this, but like I love haunted house movies and the haunted house vibe of this movie is impeccable. Some of the scares are some of my favorite scares in all of horror. So just what they did technically with this one and just the going back to the 80s, I loved it. So I was not feeling fatigue with this one for sure.
Yeah, I kind of did the same thing. I didn't watch these along in theaters. I did the binge approach as well, but they were releasing them every year at this point. So like, you know, at one point they're trying to be like, oh, we can't let the excitement die. But at the same time, like, okay, if you're making them that fast, are you going to, you know, lose any quality? I don't think they did here. Maybe we'll get into more of that next episode with PA4. Kim Newman of Empire was a little bit more positive, giving it 3 out of 5, saying, if you don't expect innovation from a part three, then this won't disappoint. It may be hokey, but the scares still work, which I find fascinating because, yes, it does echo a lot of things that were done in the first two films. But at the same time, this adds in so much like more lore and things into this one.
That's how you make these movies once a year. That's how you make a Saw once a year. You follow a formula. Like, it's such an easy formula. And we'll get into this later, but I think that they use the formula here so well that it didn't feel formulaic because of the added little kids. There's a little bit more going on with the lore there. We'll get into it. But I mean, like, I think now it's easier for us to look back and be like, wow, they were really doing some really smart stuff for like trying to get these done every year. But I think back then I can see how people are like, God damn, another movie of these. So like, but still, it's impressive that they were able to make some pretty consistently good movies for a bit, despite having to pump them out so quickly.
Yeah, we talk, I mean, obviously we do franchises here on the podcast. So, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, a franchise kind of having its formula to a degree. And, you know, there's certain times you stick to the formula and then there's certain times, you know, you add some new stuff into it. And I think this film kind of does a nice job of that. This was released on DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand January 24th, 2012, including the unrated director's cut, lost tapes, aka deleted scenes, and the theatrical version as well. Did everyone watch the extended one for this one, or did anyone rewatch the theatrical?
Oh, now I don't know, because I didn't. Are you ever too lazy to get out your Blu-rays and so you watch it on streaming? I'm terrible
all
about
the time.
That. Yeah. I'm terrible about that. I was like, oh, I gotta get the remote. I'll just watch it on. So I watched it on Max or whatever, HBO.
That's how I watched
it. So I don't know what version that is, I guess.
I guess you would know by the runtime. The original is 83 minutes and then the extended is 93 minutes.
The one on Max is just the theatrical.
Okay. That checks out.
Gotcha. See, I almost did the same thing because I was like, do I stay in bed and watch this one? But the Blu-ray player's out in the living room. But I went out and because I've been trying to watch the extended versions of all these and kind of seeing I even have the scene by scene breakdown of the differences, like where it's extended to. So I can fill in some blanks for you guys here a little bit later. I kind of did a little switcheroo-ski of background info and initial reactions. Mike, feel free to do some editing if you need to. But let's get our initial reactions for Paranormal Activity 3. And now we'll start with our guest, Mary Beth.
So this is one of my favorites, if not. It's like 1 and 3 kind of are interchangeable for me sometimes with favorites. And it's so interesting, like, hearing what critics said when it first came out, because when I saw it when it first came out, I was so excited, especially when we're going to talk about it, the oscillating fan bit, which is, like, I know that Jess, you tweeted about it, too, so I'm, like, so excited to talk about it, because it's such, like, an incredible moment in this movie, and I think that this is an example of, like, a contemporary franchise still doing cool things 3 entries later, and that found footage has a staying power if you know what, like, how to make it fresh and make it cool and make it feel scary. Because, I mean, if anything, this is, like, a modern Poltergeist to me, and so much of it is, like, Poltergeist. There's the bedroom in this movie is, like, the exact, like, when I first saw it, I'm like, I'm sorry, is this Poltergeist house? Like, the bedrooms look identical, and she's even like smoking a joint, like when we have that incredible scene of him smoking a joint and reading Ronald Reagan's biography in bed in Poltergeist, we have a similar scene where they're in bed smoking a joint and he's filming her while they smoke, while she smokes. And I love that this is a modern Poltergeist, even though it takes place at the same time period, but it's such an interesting take on what if Poltergeist was filmed with a mixed family instead of like the American Dream family, and what if it was with found footage. And I love that. I love this updated kind of idea of the haunted house, like you were talking about, Jessica. And I just think it's really smart in how it uses kids and analog, even though it didn't do it a great job. But for 2011, I think it's really interesting. And once again, just an incredibly smart entry into the franchise that's always trying to innovate and kind of get ahead of the game. So.
Yeah, totally. And Ari, you weren't here for PA2, so right. How do you feel about this being a prequel as a follow-up to the second one?
Yeah, I think the third movie in a franchise is a great time to slip a prequel in there, especially because the first two movies leave so many open ends that they can start to follow up on in the third movie. What I think is really impressive about this franchise overall is that even though it is following a formula, every movie does something different. And I don't really buy it that a wedding photographer would attach his camera to an oscillating fan, but I love it anyway, because we'd never seen that before. At least I hadn't. And, you know, I think like in the second one, they use a lot of security cam footage, and that was the different thing they did. And so in the third one, they're doing something totally different. And so I appreciate that so much from a franchise trying to follow one story but keep things really fresh. So I actually don't remember if I saw this in theaters or not. I'm guessing I probably didn't. But I think I saw it shortly after it was available on like VOD. And basically, that's how I felt about it at the time. I was like, you know what? This is kind of silly, found footage, but it's really fun. So I'm in.
And Jessica, we've already heard a little bit about your love for the oscillating fan cam. So how do you feel about the film as a, in general?
No, I agree with everything Mary Beth said. Like, I was making so many notes about like, okay, this is from Poltergeist. This is from Poltergeist. This is from Poltergeist. I just love that it's kind of an updated slash contemporary version of Poltergeist. But I loved this movie. I was so excited. I geek out a lot on the mechanics and the psychology of scares. I'm really interested in that, like what you do with the camera, what you do, how you anticipate and manipulate the audience's perspective and their expectations. And I just thought this was really smart from that vantage point. I thought it was very scary. I thought it was, I liked having more, focusing more on kids than Christy and for heaven's sakes, Katie as adults. I absolutely love this one. I was so excited when I first saw it. I honestly haven't shut up about that fan since I saw this movie years ago, and I will never shut up about it.
The same.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that Ari pointed out that it's like, yes, each one does kind of have its like own distinction. Whenever I did like my last like binge, which was like a few years ago, that's like in my Letterboxd reviews, I was like, okay, this is the domestic, abusive relationship one. This is this one. This is the prequel. And then later on, we have the Christmas one. We have the Chronicle-esque superhero ghost powers one. We still got some interesting corners to get to, but I really like this one as well. I think seeing Katie and Christy as kids is really great. Because it's usually like the third or fourth movie is where we get like the prequel put in there somewhere. And so I like that, you know, we get, you know, references to, you know, the little nuggets that they set up in the first and second one. Like, oh, yeah, we had, you know, experiences when we were kids, but we don't really remember it. So I like being able to go back into this one, and we switch things up a little bit where we don't have a shitty husband in this one. But we have a quite,
thank God,
we have a quite good stepdaddy boyfriend in this one. Which
golden retriever man.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about Dennis. I love him. I really like the kind of family dynamic that they have going in this one. And also, I think the aesthetic was like set really well, because it's the house is similar to the first two houses, but it's still different, and mm-hmm. you know, the setting of this one. And yeah, I think they do some clever camera things with this one being the first one where it's like it's actual somebody with filmmaking background filming the event. So you get some different shots here and a little bit of innovation as well. And I think this one is also super creepy, especially as the lore expands and reveals itself. I remember the first time watching this, and when we see cult grannies, I was just like, oh my god, what is happening? Like, I did not see that coming. So excited to dive more into that. But I think the best place to start is establishing the setting timeline, and that can be our point for our found footage questions here. So the film is set in 1988, like we said, 18 years prior to the events of PA 1 and 2. And we see that we get a cut of Katie dropping boxes over to Christy and Daniel. And one of these boxes has some videotapes in it. And we see that in PA 2, during the quote unquote break-in that they thought, and how nothing was missing, the box of tapes was missing. So for my theory here, because the film then does like a kind of spooky staticky cut, is Toby the one that found the footage, and is he the editor of these films? Because the first two are presented as it's like, oh, Paramount found this footage and they're the ones releasing it. But the only other person to find this would be for Toby, and for like Toby propaganda, so people can witness him and his paranormal shenanigans. That's the only way that this kind of makes sense, because if otherwise, then they're kind of breaking some found footage rules here. So what do we think about the way that this was presented as a prequel and a found footage film? Who found these tapes and who edited it?
You know, weirdly enough, hadn't really thought about that until I read the outline for this, and I was like, wow, I really just haven't. I liked Paranormal Activity so much, I just like didn't care. You know what I mean? Like,
there are some
movies where I'm like, I don't fully need to understand like the timeline. It's a movie. And I know that that sounds like I don't want to engage with what I'm watching. That's not true. Just sometimes I don't care, and like, I don't need it to make full sense to me. But now that you say this, I'm thinking that we see Katie bringing the tapes over. What if, even if it's Toby through Katie, she's getting the tapes, and like she's, because she's kind of like the vehicle for the coven. And I'm assuming that the coven does not want to get any of this out. And so my thought is that she's the one that takes the tapes. And reasoning for how these ones got out and all that, couldn't tell you. But my thoughts were it's something about Katie taking them and
working
with them.
That's where I come down to. I think it's Katie. Yeah, I think it's Katie as Toby. Yeah.
Oh, so Katie dropped it off as Katie, but then getting the tapes is her. Because I also have a theory on Toby kind of being split into Horcruxes amongst the girls and the mom. So that can also be a thing. We'll get into more of that a little bit.
Oh,
you think about
it. Wait, can I just say something very quickly that we can talk about later?
Mm-hmm.
This movie walked so Hereditary could run.
Oh, most we'll
yes. Out. Oh, 100%. 100%.
I have some Vavitch comparisons as well. You know, our Black Phillip and Toby cousins or brothers. They're both like kind of
my god
demons. This universe, it could go anywhere. Ari, what do you think about the way that the found footage is displayed and presented in the film?
Well, now my mind is completely blown, and I'm just like thinking about Horcruxes. I really enjoy your idea, Devon, that Toby is the editor, and I would like to lock that in as headcanon because it's fun. It probably is something more like working through Katie. But Toby, I just want to ride with Toby. That sounds fun to me.
See, this is the this is
Toby opening up Premiere and like trying to put in all the right glitches and like doing. He's just like, God damn it, I can't get the right keyframes. And he's just like
sipping a coffee.
There's
hunched
a,
there, over like this.
There's a point where the footage is cutting back and forth between Julie and Dennis having a conversation and then Katie getting spooked by Toby, and it's cutting back and forth. Toby set up his scares. He goes, ooh, let me show him how scary I can be. And like, he made some choices.
I mean, demons are always so dramatic. I feel like they love a performance.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Like they want to be seen. They want the attention. They want to be recognized. I feel like, you know, that also kind of goes
behavior.
So much so. And I think that goes into the treatment between Christy and Katie. You know, we have young Christy that she acknowledges him and she's the one that's talking to him, versus Katie is the doubter. And that's why she gets, you know, thrown around so much and things like that. So fascinating there. So where should we go to? Do we want to talk about Dennis, the one that is filming the found footage, or do we want to go into more kind of Toby background?
Talk about Dennis first.
Yeah, let's talk about stepdaddy Dennis. He is not the stepdad. He is the dad that stepped up and got his back broken because of it. I made a tweet about it this morning, and a lot of other people, there's a whole Dennis fan club out here, because as I kind of go into it, Dead Meat actually just did a bracket of worst boyfriends and husbands in horror, and of course Mika was on there, and of course we all hated Dan in the second one as well. But we get Dennis here, who is he loves these girls, he loves Julie, and he is actually the one that kind of takes on the more role that we've kind of seen in other paranormal horror films, where it is usually it's the female character that is the one that is being doubted, the one that nobody believes, the one that's a little bit more curious. And we have Dennis doing that here on top of being just a general good dude. So what do we think about Dennis and about his want to film all of this?
He wants to film it all, but he doesn't let it derail him. There's the earthquake, he doesn't grab his camera before running to check on the girls. He just goes to check on them and comes back for the camera later. And like that would be unheard of in these movies up to this point. And so, you know, I'm still kind of like, do you got to film everything? But at least he puts the girl's safety first. Kind of.
And yeah, he is like the rare endearing male character in the series. But I also, because I have an incredible stepdad, I love a lovable stepdad character, because you don't get those a lot. So I just love the representation, because I'm a very lucky person who has a good stepdad. And so to see that is very sweet. And I think it's in the notes, someone, I'm sorry, I can't remember, who wrote about consent and how he is like, I want to film us having sex, but he's not trying to force her. He's like asking her. And she goes, yeah, okay. He goes, really? Like he does the double, like he does like the full on, like multiple confirmations. Mm-hmm. And it's really, again, it's so rare to see that kind of like equality and power dynamic in a relationship in horror in general. Mm-hmm. And to see him respect her so much and then her also respect him, it makes this feel like everyone's a unified front. This isn't about like a family that is falling apart, even though it's not like the typical nuclear family. It's actually quite a happy family, even though it's different from what you would expect, especially in 1988. Which makes what happens all the more tragic, because it's like they found happiness despite tragedy. Like, do they say what happens to the dad? I can't even remember what happens. Does he just leave them?
Remember. Lois at one point says the girls miss their father, but that's about it. It doesn't say that's if he died or if he just left. They keep that pretty ambiguous.
Okay. But like, it just makes this all the more upsetting that it all falls apart like it does.
And honestly, I always root for Dennis probably the most when he's having the tea party with Christy and Toby is sitting there, and he's very respectful. He's like, oh, is this Toby's seat? Oh, I'm so sorry, Toby. Let me sit here. And he's like very respectful to Toby, who he thinks is her imaginary friend at this mm-hmm. point, or he's mostly thinks it's her imaginary friend. He's got his doubts, but like, he's so respectful of her play and her imagination and like her boundaries as a little girl, which is rare, like in film and in real life, like mm-hmm. respecting kids and being like, just, he's so careful and so respectful and so like aware of everyone's boundaries. Even if he doesn't think those people actually exist, he's still aware of their boundaries and respecting them. I just love that. And I'm so sad that he gets that Toby kills him when he was so nice to Toby. I'm like, Toby, he let you have your seat. He was very nice to you. Leave him alone.
That's such a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's very respectful to the girls, and he obviously loves them. I love, I'm the same with Mary Beth. Like, my primary mother figure growing up has been my stepmom, and like, you know, and it's, so it's like, it is always nice that you don't have to play on the trope of like, oh, you know, like, I want to, I don't trust the step parent, you know, and that becomes like kind of a B plot of it all, which it's never that, you know, and we yeah. even get, we even get two pretty good guys in here. Randy's a pretty good guy too. You know, in his little, sparse scenes as well. But yeah, so I really like Dennis a lot. And I feel like even again, like the consent moments and things like that are directly opposite of what we see in Mika and Daniel. So I think it's nice that, you know, that they kind of notice that, and then we're like, okay, we can kind of do something here with that. And these little girls, specifically Jessica Tyler Brown playing young Christy, one of the cutest kids that's ever been on film, up there with like a little kid Andy Barkley as like one of just the most adorable little girls in here. What do you guys think about the child performances and how they mirror adult Katie and Christy, which we've gotten to spend a good amount of time with?
I love them. I really think they're such good little kid actors. I think it's so easy for kid actors to be like really bad and overwrought and like too creepy, but she's not creepy, but there is something like a little bit uncanny about the little mm-hmm. one sometimes to me, and I don't know what it is, and I feel bad because like, and maybe it's because she's so cute looking and like she's got like, she's missing her bottom teeth, and it's just like, nothing gets my heart more than when little kids have like the big gaps in their teeth. Like, if you want me to be think your child is cute, just show me a child that's like smiles and there's just like big gaps. I don't know why, it makes my heart melt. I think they also feel so real as little kids. Like, they don't feel like they're acting. They just feel like little kids being little kids. And I think it also helps that I love their room and how it is such a fantastical space, and how you can tell that these kids are allowed access to their imagination and they are allowed access to like play. And that this is, again, a very loving household where these girls are allowed to express themselves however they want. So that's why I think Toby doesn't feel as scary at first, because it's like, oh yeah, she's just like another imaginary friend she has. Like, it's totally fine. And I feel like that helps this feel all the more real and not just like a third entry in a franchise that's meant to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And that helps it, again, just like not feel and actually get invested in the story.
Yeah, I think honestly, I think part of what makes her not necessarily creepy, I think the costuming, like that little white gown is so eerie and ghostly.
Yeah.
Like, that's that just like, she's not a creepy kid. Like, she's not scary looking. Like, she's adorable and a normal looking kid, but like, that just makes her look a little ghostly, a little unearthly. And it's just, but it still looks realistic. Point. It's not like they dressed her up like an 18th century ghost. What the hell? But no, it's like a normal little kid gown from the 80s, but it's just creepy enough that it's like seeing her walk down the hallway in the middle of the night is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like Mary Beth pointing out their space, because like, they have the, you know, really nice room, and it's like in like off to the side is like the playroom area too. Like, this is a like big lofted space. And we mentioned in PA2 how Daniel had two man caves. If this was Dan's house, they would have had that super nice room up there. They wouldn't have had the nice lofted room. They would have had, you know, one of the smaller ones if it was one of the other guys. But like you guys said, like, they are allowed and given this space together. which I think is really interesting. And I know we also mentioned in PA2 that we didn't really get to know Christy all that well. So I think it was nice that we do get to spend so much time with little Christy in this one. And small Katie, she actually plays off of like adult Katie's like kind of personality, like really well with like kind of her doubts with at certain points, but then also her, you know, moments of like genuine fear as well. I think she played off of like adult Katie pretty well. Like I think they did really well with the casting here.
Mm-hmm. And you said, mentioned the space just super quick. This is once again, and again, I don't know the situation of the divorce, but Jesus, a single mom with a house that big with like all of that furniture, like good for her. You know what I mean? Yes. And also I'm assuming it's her name because it's her house on the mortgage, not a man's house. So once again, and again, this is me assuming, but good for her. Look at this bitch go. I love it. It's always the Paranormal Activity movies where, and this is in most horror movies, where you have to like suspend disbelief about like, how do you have a house this big? But these houses that they pick are just exquisitely like designed and put together. And however, if it's multiple houses or one house, however they do it, they just always nail the production design so well.
Yeah.
And especially here and making it feel like with the lamps and like the kind of furniture, they just nail that aesthetic, even if it's a contemporary house. So I just wanted to point that out really fast.
Yeah, and there's also a scene too where Lois is talking to Julie and saying like, yeah, Dennis is nice, but like I don't trust him, like he doesn't have a steady enough job, or like he's not gonna be able to support you financially, not acknowledging that, like you guys said, it's like she's already doing fine. She doesn't need to have him be the, you know, the quote-unquote breadwinner. She's like, I already have the house and everything, like, so like calm down there for a sec. But I feel like that also ties into, you know, the whole cult aspect of it, this whole idea of like, you know, these are these are cult grannies, these are elderly witches in a coven, and they kind of have some of those like older ideas, and they are, you know, really trying to summon Toby, this ultimate, you know, male authority figure, versus, you know, we kind of have Julie and the girls going against that. So I want to give Jessica here to kind of talk about how, you know, this you know, generational divide can be connected to Toby, as well as kind of the monstrous feminine aspects that we've discussed a little bit with Katie, but also now we have the grandmothers to loop into it.
Yeah, my notes on this are long, I'm sorry, because there are a few different points I wanted to get into on this. First, I'll dive into the monstrous feminine. So that's, you know, the monstrous feminine film, Feminism Psychoanalysis by Barbara Creed, where she explores how, as opposed to like women just being the victims in horror films, women are, you know, monsters represent male fear of the female body, about female reproduction, about being castrated. And I'm really interested in how the first two films, like, one is about toxic masculinity and domestic abuse. Two is about toxic masculinity because Daniel is this racist, misogynist dick. three, we've got a great, I don't want to conflate being a bad person and a bad character. So I'm not going to say we have a good character here and they were bad characters. But, you know, Dennis is a great guy. We're not looking at a toxic male dynamic here. This one turns things on its head, where the fault, quote unquote, or blame goes back to women, because, you know, Lois and the Coven of Women set all of this into motion. It kind of retroactively, not necessarily exonerates the men in the previous two entries, but it kind of says, well, women started all of this. I wanted to know if y'all thought this was like regressive or reactionary in any way, that it's kind of like, oh, but really the women are at fault. Because I just think that's really interesting that it kind of flips things, like, you know, the real culprits here are this coven of women who want wealth and power, and they'll manipulate men and, you know, give away firstborn sons to get what they want.
I mean, not to be the guy to be the first one to say something, but I wanted to get your guys' opinion on if it, again, has to do with like this, like kind of the generation divide between them, because we have the, you know, the coven that are, you know, from a, you know, older time, even from the 80s, you know, think about where it was at the 80s and then even, you know, earlier than that versus, again, we kind of have this, again, you know, quote unquote, non-traditional family in many different ways, whether it be the power dynamics, whether it be the jobs and things like that, the family aspect itself. So again, I wonder if it's like, you know, I don't know if it's regressive. I just wonder if it's maybe a statement on the previous generations.
I'm putting this all together on the spot here. So if it doesn't make sense, I apologize. Cause I'm like kind of connecting. Has everyone seen Seven here? Can I talk like very briefly about Seven? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spoil too much, but there's also a monstrous feminine figure in Seven. Mm-hmm. And that's also whatever. We won't go too far into that and everything, but I think to me, and I think this has evolved since I've started watching this, and I think about this a lot with religious horror, is like, we are so quick to be, because they name it like Toby, and you think, oh, it's a male demon. There's a male force. And I think it all especially makes sense in like Paranormal Activity 1 in regards to like male forces fighting over Katie. But for some reason, watching it this time, I was like, what if this is a genderless being and women just rule the world? And like, they just said, fuck men, and they're sacrificing things to like an unknowing entity, and we just want to give it a gender. I also was a little bit stoned, so like absolutely could be bullshit. But I was thinking about this because we like, again, it's easier to think on a binary 100%. And like when I write about this movie, I write about Toby as male. But in watching this one in particular, with this inclusion of now a coven, and again, covens of, like, that's not to say that covens of witches don't worship the devil as a male figure. I know that, but. There's something about it that it to me, and perhaps this is also my kind of current ideas of like, a lot of times they're killing men, and like, I know like selling firstborns and things like that, but here it becomes like a very weirdly matriarchal kind of society, like satanic matriarchal society. Not saying it's a good thing, but it's an interesting kind of, again, I'm comparing it to Hereditary in terms of like women inheriting these things and women doing these things. But again, in Hereditary, she's also doing it for a male figure. Like Payman is very much coded as male. So it is really interesting. I don't necessarily think it's progressive, but I can definitely see why it can be seen that way. Because it does have that taste of like women ruin everything. But maybe for me, just because I love when like covens of witches doing evil shit, I'm like, yeah, look at them. They're trying to fight back against the patriarchy just because we see them especially kill men in this one. And I also have a theory that perhaps they dispatched of the previous husband as well. Yeah. Maybe. Mm.
I thought maybe he figured something out, or he found something or saw something.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Like there's, good. I don't know what it is, but I think that especially when like Lois is there helping like make the beds and talking about it, it just had the vibes of like, this is the mom that you like, the mother-in-law you don't want. Like she really does get rid of you if you come too close to the family. So yeah, I don't know. There's something in this movie that feels, I don't get the vibe in the other ones, but it feels very more matriarchal in this one in terms of like, we don't need men. Again, that's only this one though, from what I can remember, but right. that's my vibe on that.
Yeah. And I'm not, I don't even know what my opinion is yet, because I was, you know, literally writing these notes like 20 minutes before we started recording. And I was just kind of like getting,
no, it's
down,
a cool
was,
thing though. It's
yeah,
a cool
like,
thought,
I was
though.
Like, mm-hmm. I just literally want to ask y'all what you think, especially because Devon, what you said about the witch or the vvitch, I am fascinated with the idea that Katie and Thomason are the same, because Thomason has to choose between, you know, the patriarchal church or patriarchal Satan. And she's like, well, this way I get dresses and butter, but they're both shitty choices. And, you know, Katie, she's got Mika or she's got Toby, both shitty choices, but one, maybe she has slightly more agency or slightly has to put up with slightly less bullshit. Like she's stuck between a rock and a hard place with two different patriarchal structures. And maybe that's what this movie is digging into more deeply, is where you're stuck between two bad choices and you're coding it as patriarchal, like calling him Toby instead of some name that doesn't have quite as much gender associated with it. So mm-hmm. I really like that comparison that you made. Cause I, when you said that, I started thinking about like how it relates to one, how it kind of relates to this idea of the men in their lives versus this amorphous figure that they have decided to code as a man, though it's not necessarily a male figure.
I mean, I don't want to take power or agency away from the Coven of Witches, but I also, I guess for me, in the more fear and like scary viewpoint of it is like, yes, like the events we're, you know, were set in motion by this Coven of Witches doing this. But at the same time, you know, they mention it, you know, the picture from like the 1930s, the 1950s. What drove those women to make this decision to join this coven and to sign this, you know, power over into this entity, you know, getting promised wealth. But at the end of the day, so it's like, you know, yes, they are evil and they are, you know, and it's, you know, immorally apprehensible, like offering up your family's firstborn male child. But at the same time, I still feel like it's like they're still a victim of, you know, patriarchal structures from, you know, decades past, even before that. So it's like, for me, even though like, yeah, I on one hand, is it cool to be like Katie being possessed and taking out her shitty boyfriend? Good for her. But at the same time, I'm like, but at the same time, it's like, ah, but at the end of the day, this is all still going back to, you know, patriarchal oppression from before. So it's like at the end of the day, even when they still have this power, they're still underneath the, you know, this kind of greater power as well. And like, so like that still like makes it like sad and more tragic in a way for me. Yeah. What about you, Ari?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking about, you know, this coven, once you have power, you don't want to give it up. And so wherever it started from, whatever set the original events in motion for this coven to form and do their thing, no one wants to be the one to be like, hey, guys, I think we should let go of our power and stop doing this because it's wrong. And so you can really just like keep the momentum going and keep the ball rolling, whether you really want to or not. And so it is definitely something that I'm just going to be militantly feminist for a second. So women have to watch out for times when we're told something is empowering, but we're not given any power. Like empowering has become a branding word to say, women, you should be happy about this, but empowering is actually having power. And so I think this coven is sort of an example of what does it mean to really have power and not just feel empowered. And so like, I don't necessarily want to say good for her, but also like trying to hold on to the power that you do have makes a lot of sense to me.
I like that.
Yeah, yeah, I totally.
Good for her, asterisk, and like the fine print underneath.
Yeah, fine print underneath, but is it?
Really
like,
good for her. Yeah.
Yeah. I like your note here, Jessica, too, about like, yes, like I'm one of those horror fans that has also had a little bit of trauma fatigue. But like you kind of pointed out when it's like the more direct metaphor versus like kind of, you know, trauma in a, idea sense versus it being like kind of the singular thing. And that's where, you know, this is the first time we even get the name of Toby is in this film. So like even putting identity specifically on it is interesting, but at the same time, we don't get to see Toby at least for another few more movies.
Yeah. And yeah, my point about that, like, I know obviously this movie was 13 years ago and like, this was not, I know, I don't think this was a thing at that, but I see a lot of fans today say, oh my god, I'm so tired of horror as the monster is a metaphor for trauma, I'm so tired of this. And I'm not like denigrating those people or like casting like throwing shade at those people, because if you're tired of it, you're tired of it. I personally don't get tired of that because I love it when movies dig into trauma, and I think the way this movie rolls back generational trauma is really interesting, like going back these first three entries, especially the third one, and looking at like, you know, things that you inherit from your mother and your grandmother and like just the way you're raised and like the actions of somebody three generations ago can have such a big impact on you today. I think that's interesting, and those kinds of things still really, really speak to me personally. But I'm curious how people view it, you know, again, hindsight, like how you view this movie today, where some people are very fatigued by that kind of thing. But I really like the way it approaches that, where you're going back in time and kind of looking at understanding the characters that we met in one and two after you know more about where they come from, and you're like, okay, I see how they were raised, how their parents were raised, you know, things like that.
I also, this makes me think about the Satanic Panic a lot, and how people thought a lot about like repressed memories and how people were abused, but this movie kind of shows, maybe exposes those, like those hidden memories, and exposes actual truth. Like, this isn't, you know, and with Satanic Panic, there was a lot of talk about more abuse stuff, but I think because this is from 1988, it kind of plays with that idea of Satanic Panic and exposing memories that might, because again, like Katie talks a lot about not remembering, and it feels a lot like, and I think there was notes, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, about like why they don't remember a lot of this. And I always thought like, oh, it's like repressed memory. Like that's like classic capital T trauma shit of like repressing big chunks of memory. And this is like looking into that repressed memory from Katie in a way, which I think also makes it feel more intimate if you're as invested in the series as I am.
Yeah.
But it does feel intimate, like, oh, you're getting back into their memories. Because again, it's a home videotape too. It like feels way more intimate as well.
Like my mom found this, you know, those photo booth pictures with like the four quick snapshots. Like my mom found some of those of me, my sister, my mom, and my great aunt that we took when I would have been about 12 or 13. And I have zero recollection of that happening. I've never seen these pictures in my life. I did not know these existed. And it was such a weird, like, I felt like the Dolly Zoom in Jaws. It was like this weird zeroing in on like something in my past that I have no recollection of happening. Like I have so many like years from my childhood that I don't remember. So when something like that snaps me into, oh my God, that existed. Like, I think that's one reason I love this one so much. Cause like the idea of watching my own home videos as a kid and being like, oh, that happened. Oh, I didn't know that happened. You know, I just, it really connects with me personally. So
it freaks me out. No, it's weird though. And like the idea of like the thought of her not, of like Katie not remembering these things and like seeing them happen, and like the thought huge, of learning all this things. Shit. These core memories, not in a good way. But then learning someone, either your own brain or maybe a person, took that away from you is just like so violating.
This might poke a hole in my Tobias editor theory, because like, again, if he's going to erase their memories of, you know, the events of this happening, then why is he going to make this movie and get the tapes back? Or unless he was, you know, getting the evidence back. Because we did say
he loves a performance, so he could be being like, this is my actor's reel, but so, demons.
So I mean, I think this is I think this is where it's fascinating, because like this is also where Toby doesn't have as much power as the coven, because basically he just needs to get into this body, you know, but he's not really kind of actually doing anything. He's doing the scare bits, versus the coven, Lois has to do this whole cover-up thing. Is she the one that erases Katie and Christie's memories of this and then just raises them as their own? Because Mike made a note, I think, about in the first movie, Mika says, oh, don't let your mother hear, she's mean, whenever they're talking about, you know, not bringing bad energy to the house. And then in two is where we get, you know, Christie talking to Katie about these memories that she can't recall, but she like has like a bad feeling about that happened. And Katie is, again, very dismissive, as she is as a child as well, so that like kind of holds up. So like what, like so I guess how this was all in service for them to at least, okay, Julie couldn't provide a son, she, and you know, Lois even noted, she was like, yeah, you should really try for a third kid. And she's like, no, I think I'm good with two. I got two daughters. And she's like, oh, but you always wanted a son. She's like really pushing this. So do you think they gave up on Julie, and now the brainwashing was a part of keeping Christy and Katie somewhat viable for a baby boy in the future?
I think that tracks.
Oh, yeah. They couldn't pull a payment again with her, like with Hereditary, they couldn't pull a payment and like just pull a few strings. They really needed a boy. I'm stuck on the Hereditary comparison. I'm sorry. It just, it's,
no, it's totally valid, though.
I can't
though.
Stop
it's
thinking
there.
About thinking about it.
Yeah.
Especially, yeah, I can't stop thinking about watching it this time. I'm just like, yeah, wow, this really is like Hereditary, pre-Hereditary vibes of like the like predetermined, you can't escape and it fucking sucks and you sorry, you just have to let it happen to you, like that predetermined stuff. Yeah,
no, the similarities are definitely there. It's actually like really fascinating. But you know, in Hereditary, it's more of, you know, the grandmother's a presence. Like, we open the movie with her dying, with the grandmother dying, but like her presence still looming, versus this one, it's like, oh no, not only is grandma still around, her whole squad is around and they're circling the house right now. Yeah, it's some crazy stuff in this one. Let's talk about some of the scares here, because we get some really good stuff. And I mean, I think we should obviously start with the you know, one of the hour, the oscillating fan. I think this is so fun, just a creative way to get some camera movement in the film. But the setup, I love the patience of it. Like, you know, you start getting the timing down of like how far it takes to pan, then when it's gonna go back, and then it's like, oh no, we're going back for some more, and then like, oh, I thought I saw something in the corner, but now it's in the next room. I like how it's between the two rooms. I think that's works really well for the signature scare here. Mary Beth, what did you think the first time you saw some of these oscillating fan scares?
I thought I was gonna fucking pee my pants, to be perfectly honest with you. I was like, it's like not something you see of the camera, one fluid motion moving back and forth and hiding things and then exposing them. And it's like so simple, but no one had ever done it. Cause again, it's not like it's not like a traditional camera technique you use in narrative filmmaking. And again, like who really attaches a camera to an oscillating fan? But that's because we have an intrepid filmmaker here and we love that. It's just so smart. And it was just because we have, there's a couple scares with it, and I really do use it to like its maximum effect. And I love that, because I feel like in so many of these movies, they'll do one scare with something and then like never do it again. But here they really play with it, because we have there's Christy running down and like getting on the fucking table and talking to the ceiling, which is absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She also just children climbing on things. I have too many little cousins I've seen eat shit. I'm like, no, she's going to fall. But then also we have the mom coming downstairs and like getting a drink of water and the light bulb exploding. And we have then like the absolutely iconic babysitter moment with the ghost, which is absolutely incredible, and preceded by the jump scare where she goes boo, which
oh my god I
still love it.
Yeah,
but then we have, I forgot about this one, when all of the fucking kitchen furniture is on the ceiling and you just see her face and you're like, oh no, what the hell? And it's just this slow reveal of everything, and you can't see anything on the ceiling, and then it all dropping down. It's like that part again, Poltergeist, but turned up to 11. It isn't just the chairs anymore. It's the entire kitchen. And we see that a little bit in 2 with like all the cabinets opening or like flying open and the drawers. But here it's the whole kitchen. And I just think they use the oscillating fan to perfection. They use it enough, but they don't overuse it, I think. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it still makes me nervous.
Oh my God. Yeah. I had forgotten about the boo, and I jumped in bed. I was like, oh shit, what the fuck? But yeah, like I tweeted out at like my Letterboxd review, I really should write actual Letterboxd reviews, but I usually just write like 2 words
get
or something.
Paid to write reviews. My Letterboxd don't write them.
Right. I'm like, y'all can pay me. Y'all can pay me for it. Or I'll put it on my own website, not on your website for free. But no, my Letterboxd review was like, this is like one of the most, like this is the most influential thing in 21st century horror, fight me. And like, I'm just going to read my notes, because I was like, at the beginning of the recording, I was like writing several pages, not really like a paragraph, but like this paragraph about why I legitimately think it's like so revolutionary. Like, so you're marrying the objective with the subjective, and you're manipulating the frame and the viewer's vision. And it's such a genius way to get the best of both worlds with regard to found footage versus, you know, typical narrative films where a character is usually not actually controlling the camera. And, you know, it's technically brilliant. The timing's impeccable. And you have this agonizing wait to see what's going to appear, if something's going to appear. And like, the unknown is scarier than anything else. So I love delayed gratification in horror. So they combine, we know the timing of the camera movement because you get a feel for the timing of the oscillation as it bounces back from side to side. So they combine the known with the unknown with, like, we know the timing, but we don't know what's happening outside the frame. And to me, horror, more than any other genre, is just as much about what happens outside the frame as what happens inside it. And the directors, like, more than most films I've watched, they understand how to manipulate your understanding of what's happening outside of the frame while they're controlling every tiny detail inside the frame. And to me, that moves found footage forward, that moves horror forward, and it's just such a smart and holistic, and like Mary Beth said, it's so simple. It's so like I could put up a camera on top of an oscillating fan right now. Like, it's so simple, but it's so brilliant, and it's such like a galaxy brain view of like viewer psychology and horror scares and like outside the frame, inside the frame, controlling everything. And it's just genius. And thank you for letting me read that thesis.
No, I appreciate it, because like I was thinking some of the same things. I was like, oh man, I hope it's like, I could see this film like maybe upsetting like found footage like purists, you know, because this one kind of does start feeling more like a film compared to the first two, I will say. At which, again, like on one point, yes, you're kind of missing the blurred lines action, but then again, I already know I'm watching a movie. You're not going to trick me. So like, if you want to take some liberties so that way we can, you know, kind of play around with some different techniques and scares, then I'm all for it. Because yeah, I think especially the ghost sheet one is so great, because I didn't realize in the shot before you see it like in it just in the left corner, like right as the fan is like going away, like so there's like a brief setup shot, because you know we've talked about how this film does a I spy approach to a lot of its scare pieces. Mm-hmm. And I think you know, it definitely was a fun one. Also a theory that I was thinking about, so that sheet scare, that's Christy. It's not Toby, because she mentions Toby's very tall. Toby's also like an animal and like kind of like has like these like heavy steps. But if you guys didn't rewatch the extended cut, did you guys not get to see the scene of Christy playing with Toby late at night? The banister scene?
No, but so, I feel like I have seen that before, because that rang a bell.
Yes. So there's one of the scenes that was cut from the theatrical version that is in the extended is it's like late at night in the girls' room, and Christy's talking to Toby, and then you know, and like Toby tells her to do things, you know. And so she climbs up on the banister and she's talking to Toby and she goes, no, it's too high. And then she goes, okay. Yeah. And she comes off, but like you don't hear her make a noise or anything. And she like kind of giggles, and then she like landed safely at the bottom. So Toby does things for her. So, and that's why she says boo. Toby wouldn't say boo. That's not his thing, you know? So I think in that sheet scene, that is Christy doing stuff through, or Toby doing things with Christy in that scene.
Crazy. Oh, I don't like that. I like the idea. I just like hate the yeah, it's freaky, because yeah, that makes a lot of sense though, because like you're right. Uh-huh. He is tall.
Yeah,
and she was
like, it's clearly a kid. Yeah,
and it gives the vibe of a little kid, like mm-hmm, of like mm-hmm, coming back yeah, down and mm-hmm, playing a prank, and it like,
yeah, which is weird that again,
ooh, I don't like it.
So that's weird that they cut that scene, because a lot of the scenes that are cut are like some of these like some extended scare sequences that were left out. But I think this one is like probably the creepiest that you know, to set up that that blanket scare.
Okay, yeah. Underrated scare though is the beginning when the fucking camera falls over and the dust like already falls on something, and mm-hmm, I forgot how quickly it turns up the scares in this movie, and how it like, how they have like, oh, he didn't grab the camera, but don't you worry, we're gonna give you something even scarier.
Right.
Like, and I love how they take what you see like in one and two in terms of like kind of exposing something, and out the gate are setting up that like, no, there is something here. And I love how this movie isn't afraid to, again, jump right into set pieces and scares, rather than holding back until the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, they like echo previous scares, because that's like similar to the footprints in the powder in the first one, and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do multiple echoes, like the kitchen scenes as well, but like this film really ups, I think, the intensity on all of those. So it's like, even though, yes, you know, we're kind of doing some of the same things, but when we're getting the leg pull scene in this one, it's, you know, a little kiddie, so it's like it's more upsetting because it's a you know, happening to a child this time versus, you know, later on. But it also still echoes, you know, Katie being dragged around in the first one and Christy being dragged around the second one. So it's like there's still echoing, but they're using the different setting and things like that, because, you know, we mentioned how in two, a lot of the scariest scenes are the ones that involve Hunter. He's a baby. But so like when you're seeing it with the girls in these ones, it's, you know, very upsetting. But because the Randy and Katie scene, I think, is super scary. The one in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. I forgot
that was a scary scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, he's such a sweet boy. I love the sweet boys. I'm just going back to it. He like starts putting the chairs back and he's like, it was just an earthquake. Don't worry.
Love him. And he's like, come on, Randy, let's go. We can do it.
Like,
oh my God, I fell in love when he said, come on.
Come on, Randy. And he goes out first to check out. Oh, I love a good dopey friend who is willing to do any, like in his little silly denim vest, and he doesn't care. He will help the child. And I respect that deeply.
Yes.
Come on.
Right?
Come on, Randy.
He's just Dennis's assistant, but he is down to come over and babysit. So good guy in that.
He's a good man.
But he's a good man. That like performance in that scene is really good, because he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, he's obviously scared shitless, but he's trying to, you know, be like, no, I'm not scared, everything's great. But then him cutting in his like inner dialogue is really fantastic. But like that table, when the table swipe goes out, that's a pretty freaky one too.
Oh, it's a good one. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a good one.
Toby said, I'm done sitting at this little ass table.
With his knees touching his chin.
For me. Yeah.
I hate Earl Grey.
Oh man. Yeah. And then I think there's so much to get into with the climax, the third act of this, mm-hmm. as we transition from, you know, the you know, kind of classic haunted house stuff. But that's also like a trope, is like whenever, like in Poltergeist, when they leave, and then, you know, it's like, oh nope, they were in like Amityville Horror, like you leave, it's still gonna follow you, you know. So it's like the bait and switch of, okay, we're gonna, and like the way they set up, it's like, oh, we're gonna go to grandma's house, which, you know, to everybody else, that's very cozy, that's comforting, and she's, as soon as they show up, she's shoving pie in everybody's face, everybody up your pie, and to be like, oh no, grandma's house is not safe at all.
Yeah,
the pie is also possessed.
Like, they change locations, they actually do change locations, which you don't really do in found footage movies like this. It's not one, you usually, it's always, there's always a reason, or like usually budgetary, but they actually go to another place, which proves like, oh, it ain't the house, y'all, like there is something. And I think it was so shocking when I first saw this, and I was like, wait, what? It's her?
Yeah.
And I think like that was really interesting to me. Like, again, we've seen like the crone in horror. It's again, it's a trope we've seen. We've seen like old witches, but not like this. And to see them extend this lore into something much bigger and much wilder than I was expecting was just like so cool. When I first saw this movie, like, I was so fucking excited. And I was like, a twist that actually freaks me out. Like, I'm so excited. It's not a cheesy twist.
Because I'm such a sucker for a jump scare where, like, you turn and, like, oh, shit, there's, like, eight scary people staring at me. I love those. I'm a sucker for those. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Absolutely.
So sorry.
No, I agree with you. And I did not see a cult of elderly people come in at all. Like, I can't remember a movie. I mean, now I'm like, oh, Hereditary. But I, at the time, wouldn't have thought of another movie when I saw this for the first time. So, like, that got me by surprise for sure.
Yeah, it totally blew my mind whenever I saw this for the first time. Like, I was just like,
before The Visit, right? Oh, yeah. Because The Visit was 2015. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry. A little bit before The Visit as well. And yeah, I just, yeah, because, like, you know, she was being a little weird throughout the movie. Like, when you rewatch it, it's also obvious, mm-hmm. you know, those conversations. But when you're watching it for the first time, again, like, we've all had those conversations with our grandma when they're like, oh, no, you should date somebody else. You should, you know, get somebody else that has a better job. Ah. And, like, it doesn't sound out of the ordinary. Like,
right.
You should give me another grandson. I would love a grandson. It's like, we all know those things. So it's like, you know, but setting it up, it just didn't even click. And then so whenever, yeah. just like, and also very funny because the series obviously continues on to be Paranormal Activity, but there's actually no ghosts because Toby's a demon. We have a coven of witchy grandmas, but no actual ghosts throughout the series.
This is what happens when you give a man make a movie for $30,000 in his house and then make it a franchise. You're stuck with the name that he randomly gave it because they didn't know what to. Literally, they didn't know what to name it. So, like, it's stuck. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. Although the sixth one is called Ghost Dimension. So who knows when we get to that, what might happen. I don't remember. So
actually, Ghost Dimension strengthens my Toby as the editor theory because it integrates the paranormal and technology more. And it does. It's not a terrible movie. It does some interesting stuff, but you know, we'll get there.
We're going to get there.
But yeah, so like, and this, you know, I love the reveal too of like whenever Dennis is like going around and like we had seen Christy looking at that painting and it's just like, oh, grandma's got demonic symbols behind the paintings, nothing out of the ordinary here, which was like, again, and then and we see Julie's kind of ambiguous fate here. So Dennis is looking for the girls, whenever you do see him wake up, what wakes him up is a car pulling up, which is hilarious. I love to imagine, you know, eight grannies pull up and, you know, they carpooled together, obviously.
Obviously. In the mystery machine,
pulling up to the club with my girls. We're ready to turn up tonight in our matching black cotton dresses.
Oh, they were so ready. But yeah, so he's but Dennis is looking for the girls, and then we see Julie levitating at the top of the stairs and then gets thrown at him. And we don't see Julie get up at any point. So is she unconscious at the end? Was she already dead in that moment when they were levitating her body? What do we think about Julie's fate for the film?
Well, they reference Katie and Christy's mom in the first movie, like we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So either Julie survives or they like switcheroo swapped replacement mother and erased her memory of Julie. Maybe that seems extreme, but who knows?
I mean, those were my two theories. Yeah, I was like, maybe Julie's mom does live, but like their memories are all boggled up and, you know, and she continues their quest to, you know, set Katie and Christy up for the bail to get the boy. Or did Julie die and then they were raised by their grandmother? Whether they knew or not, or maybe Mika just assumed that Lois was their mother, but was actually grandmother, maybe. So that's my theory. I think they were probably raised by Lois the rest of the time.
It's a good theory.
And I'm so sorry, this is like such like an annoying response. I bet it feels like from a technical perspective, they just never really thought about what to do about the mom. And then the third one came around and they're like, shit, we got to write a mom in here. And then they just like, but my non-pain in the ass answer is I like the idea that the grandma is like, is their mom now. And again, like, fucked with her memory. And because the mom was so anti what was going on, she was like, sorry, I don't care about anything but getting power from this demon. So, like, you are disposable, which we see in so many of these movies. Like, again, Hereditary. It's like, no, we don't give a fuck about any of you. Like, we just want that one. And so I could see if there's a confirmed canon about this, if the grandma, like, convinced people or, like, took on guardianship and just, like, lied to the kids and brainwashed them with whatever weird dark magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because we hear them saying, oh, we gotta get ready, is the way that the film ends, with the girls walking up with Grandma Lois. So whatever they're getting ready for, you know, but we see them in the present, they don't remember any of that stuff. So that's where my Horcrux theory comes in. That's what they were getting ready for. They're like, okay, so you guys are still young, so you guys aren't going to be having any kids anytime soon, but we still need to keep tabs on you. So they, like, did some sort of Toby, putting a little bit of Toby on them, you know, and, like, maybe that's, you know, how they eventually started getting haunted in 1 and 2, was just at some point Toby was like, ah, I know one of you is gonna have a kid soon, I gotta start doing my thing again. Not sure.
I always thought it was a wedding, like a betrothal ceremony, like the girls are, like, promised to
Toby, because there was that scene where
like they're little, these child brides. That's how I always interpreted it.
Yeah.
Sorry to say child brides, but yeah, that's
yeah, no, that one scene was very icky when they're playing dress up and grandma's like, oh, look, she's such a beautiful bride, and it's like, you don't need, no, let's not do
that. Yeah.
Please don't, thank you.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think after this they have a smidge of Toby left on them after the exchange. But oh my goodness, poor Dennis, his death. I love that gif so much. It's just fantastic. It's like, you know, spinal backbreak that either, I don't know if it's Grandma Lois does it with her mind powers or if Toby bends them backwards. One of the two. It's awful. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, it's brutal.
It's
yeah. Brutal.
And again, it's like even the good boys don't get it, you know, like, you know, obviously, like, Mika and Dan, like, of course they're going to die, but, like, you know, we don't want that for Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet, sweet Dennis got what was not coming to him, but this is post 9/11, baby. No one gets to live.
That is such a good point. I know Mike had a, did have a point in here, towards our, found footage rules portion of this was, I guess, where you would start to question, okay, Dennis, why are you still filming at grandma's house? You know, if you assume that everything was happening at your house, then by this point you'd assume when they leave and go to grandma's that he would stop filming, and then he films his search for the girls for seemingly no reason. So it's like, you know, is this Toby possessing him a little bit as well, influencing him, because Toby's got to get his ending for his film. You know, you got to get third act on film.
True. I kind of saw it as, like, he wanted to get the whole rest. There's, like, the more of the saga. It felt like the, like, well, I filmed it this far, so might as well see, like, if it keeps going. And maybe it's, like, you know, we talked about in the first one about, like, control as a method of control. Like, maybe this is the one thing that makes him feel like he's in control of the situation, is capturing it on camera and having evidence that something weird is going on. So kind of was my thought. It was like, it kind of just like, if I do this, everything, like, something will be okay. I don't know. That's what the vibe it gave me.
Yeah. Like, if I make it out of here alive, this is the only way people will believe me. If I can show them what happened. Yeah. Because otherwise, yeah, like, oh, a coven of grannies attacked me. Okay, Dennis. Like,
hey, Grandpa. Let's get you home.
Yeah, that's always my thing, too. Like, I mean, if you already started filming, I don't really have as many qualms on why are you still filming. Because, yeah, if you're already in, you might as well see it through to the end. Randy lives. Is Randy a potential finder of the footage? What if Randy's one working for Paramount this whole time?
God. Randy's been trying to solve the cold case for years.
Yeah. Bring Randy back for the next Paranormal Activity movie. That's what we need.
He's married to the babysitter, and together they're trying to solve the mystery.
Good.
I would watch that.
Yes.
I would too. I love them.
Can we talk about that babysitter for a moment, that she gets spooked twice and then just yeets out, like she just zooms out the door.
Yeah. Like, everything's good. She's fucking smart. Because she's like, no, I don't fuck with this. Because she said, I've watched the slashers of my time. I know what happens to babysitters in a scenario, and I will not be fucking with it. She is the smartest person in any horror movie.
That's why we don't see her again.
She sat by the front door waiting. She was like, I will not be doing this. You cannot make me.
She doesn't abandon the kids. She stays till the parents get home, and then she gets the hell out of there. Like, good job.
Yeah. Her and the cameraman from Scream 2, they're the survivors, the ultimate survivors, because they nope the fuck out.
Right? I forgot he's like, get no way. I fuck this. Yeah.
The ultimate just
surviving.
That's the only way to beat Toby, is you can't acknowledge him. And that's exactly what she says. I am not, nope, like nothing. And I am not she connected said, to this. I don't know your names even. Yeah. But I thought she was really funny. So yeah, headcanon of, I think, what was her name? Sydney, maybe? Sydney and Randy off together.
You just said Sydney because we're talking about Scream.
Right, Sydney and Randy. That's Randy's headcanon right there.
Yeah.
Her name was Bailey. I was close. Bailey was her name.
All right. That's closer than I thought, so I'll give you that.
Yeah. All right. Do we have any final things that we need to get in from this film? Any critiques? I know this is a high one for most of us that we'll get into when we do our rankings episode, which I'm very excited about. So is there any qualms, anything that could have made this a little bit better?
So I'm one of those horrible found footage purists who can't have any fun. No, I can, and I do. This movie is great. The only complaint I have about it is that I think it stretches the found footage idea a little bit too far outside my disbelief. But if I just set that aside, I have so much fun with this movie that I don't care as much. But like with the story itself, I don't think I have any qualms.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of split the difference with this one, because I'm like, again, we got to see what goes down at Grandma Lois's house. It's gotta
got to.
You know, so we got to get there one way or the other. But at the same time, like, I feel I appreciate it in found footage now. And so that's where I'll give the film a break, because this is 13 years ago, you know, and found footage has evolved in such a way that I feel like a lot more recent films pay more attention to being like, this is how the footage got put together. This is how it came to be.
Yeah.
Now.
Yes.
And which I love. I love seeing that in like stuff like Spree, where we actually get the source and we actually see the compilation of it, you know, put together. So that's a nice evolution. So I guess for where found footage was at this point, I'm not as hung up on it, even though that does really interest me, like the angle
of good point.
Actually found the footage. Like, I love that stuff, but for this film, I think it's fine because it makes it more ominous.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Toby being the editor, I think is just as wild as a coven of grandma witches. So
I'm all in. I love that.
So I'm all here for it. Mm-hmm. But I think we did it. I think we hit Paranormal Activity 3. Some may say this is the high point. We will see how the rest of the films go. I know from here on out, these will be first time watches for Mike.
Yeah.
I think maybe he said he saw 4 and then maybe stopped at 4. And so now we're getting into some untreaded waters for some people. I know I still haven't seen Next of Kin. That's the only one I haven't watched
Me
yet.
Me too. So
I'm excited for the lead up to that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we got some more places to go for the Paranormal Activity series. Speaking of Paranormal Activity, it's been really fun watching Mary Beth's camera as your cat triggers your door. But then there'd be like a time the door would open, and I'm like, wait, I don't see the kitty. So that has been so fun. So thank you, Mary Beth, for joining us once again to talk Paranormal Activity. Let the people know where they can find you and all the things you're working on.
Yeah, so I'm so glad I could be here. I love Paranormal Activity so much that I'm writing a book on it. So if you want to learn more about that as I'm working on it / when it's coming out, you can follow me on Twitter at MB McAndrews and on Instagram at MB McAndrews. And you should follow also my podcast, Scarred for Life. We put out new episodes every Monday with our guests that we interview about the movies that terrified them as kids. We're at Scarred Podcast on Twitter. And then also follow Dread Central everywhere because it's cool. I'm working on lots of things. So just follow me on social media to see updates on all of this shit I'm working on.
Hell yeah. I have links to all that in the links below. Ari, where can the people find you and what do you got going on?
Yes, well, you can pre-order my book, Millennial Nasties. It's coming out September 17th through Encyclopocalypse. It's an analysis of horror movies from the 2000s, torture porn and their adjacent friends. So super stoked for that. And if you can't spell Encyclopocalypse, that is totally reasonable. You can find a link to pre-order that on all my socials. So I'm Ari_Hellraiser on Twitter and Instagram. And no_ on Blue Sky. And you can follow me there for, you know, all the stuff I'm up to.
Hell yeah. And what about you, Jessica?
You can find me on Twitter at WeWhoWalkHere. I have collections of like all my writing at WeWhoWalkHere.com, like covering South by Southwest and Panic Fest and lots of other festivals. I've got some projects coming up that I am super, super, super excited about. When I'm able to announce them, you will hear a lot about them. Just follow me on Twitter at WeWhoWalkHere.
As the kids would say these days, watch this space for the big things that are coming. And you can hear me over on my podcast, Spectre Cinema Club, hosted by me and my friend Garrett McDowell, where we dive into the subgenres of horror. We are wrapping up our Women in Horror as we go into anthology films for April. So I'll actually get a little head start on our VHS coverage. I don't know if we've disclosed that to the public, but I have now. You can't stop me, Mike, unless you do it in editing. So we'll be doing anthology for all of April. Super excited for that. So you can find us everywhere at Spectre Cinema. And you can find me on Twitter, Thirsting Over Dennis, at _EddieDisco, as well as every other social media platform. Thank you for listening to this episode of Pod and the Pendulum. Thank you, Mike, for letting me take over the wheel for this one, and wishing you a speedy recovery for next episode as we hit Paranormal Activity 4 and the midway point of this franchise. You can follow the podcast at Pod and Pendulum Pod on Twitter and Instagram.